Hey, this is Mark in San Antonio, Texas. I love the Gospel Tangents podcast because it has some of the best and most diverse guests in the field of Mormon studies. They're people whose work I've read and enjoyed and that I would love to sit down and have a chat with. And the podcast lets me have that experience vicariously.
Hey, thanks, Mark, and everybody. Mark was the winner of our contest giveaway on the last 116 pages. So, Mark, this will be in the mail today or tomorrow. So check your mailbox. It'll be fun for you. Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. I'm excited to introduce an apostle and a 70 for Christ Church. David Patrick has been on the show before. You may remember him from our conversation with Ann Wilde, where we talked about Jesus was married. We're all going to be talking with him, as well as a 70 from Christ Church. His name is Benjamin Schaefer, and we're going to talk more about how their church started and some of their basic beliefs.
All right, well, welcome to Gospel Tangents. I have two amazing guests. Could you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Brother David Patrick with Christ Church, and I'm mission president in the church.
Awesome. And well, actually, you sold yourself short there, right?
Well, yes, I also am an apostle of the church as well.
So you're my second apostle I've ever interviewed. So
oh, wonderful.
That's awesome. And?
And I'm Benjamin Schaefer, Brother Benjamin is fine, of Christ Church. We are also called The Branch, and I'm a 70.
Nice. So you're my third 70. And I have to tell you something funny, because I interviewed Elder Snow a few weeks ago, and I told my wife that I was interviewing a 70, and her first response was, "For which church?" So,
very nice.
So you're the third 70, and I've done a Community of Christ 70, an LDS 70, and now the Righteous Branch. Is that what you guys call yourselves?
So officially it's Christ Church.
Christ Church.
But then also there's the title, because we believe that we're supposed to gather Israel again, that we are the Righteous Branch of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But the original name of the church is long enough as it is, so we generally don't use that one as much. So The Branch for short.
Oh, so is that the official name, the Righteous Branch of Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
Not on official documents.
Oh, okay.
No.
But you would refer to yourselves.
Well, yeah, that is one of the references. But we like it to be shorter, so it's usually just Christ Church or The Branch.
Okay, awesome. So, well, this is great. I'm really excited. So my, like I said, my third 70 and my second apostle. So this is awesome. So could you guys tell us a little bit about yourselves? I have to tell you something funny. So I attended David's presentation a couple days ago, and I noticed there were a lot of purple shirts in the audience. And I talked to one of the guys, and I was like, and I noticed y'all had missionary name tags. And so I talked to one of the guys that had a purple shirt on, and I said, so, you know, Mormon missionaries have the white shirts. Are you guys, like, into purple shirts? And he's like, no, we just decided to coordinate that day, so.
Yeah, I sent out the message, okay, this day we're going to be this color, and then purple, and then blue, and we were just coordinated.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, that morning, I was like, I wonder what I should wear, and then Joshua said, hey, we're going to wear purple shirts today, so I grabbed my purple shirt. That's all it was.
I don't even have a purple shirt, and I went to Weber State. And my son goes to Lehigh High School. They're purple, so
nice.
we'll have to invest. But then we don't want to be confused with you guys.
Right.
Now, the mission, do you guys go door to door like LDS missionaries do? Or?
Well, occasionally we do, but that's not mostly what we do. Okay. Mostly what we're doing is a lot of service.
Okay.
And we find people in need, if they need flooring help, if they need help moving a wood pile, if they need help with anything, we're pretty much there. And we're not bound by geography either. So we've sent people to Idaho, to Oregon, to southern Utah, all over the place. So we don't have the numbers of the other churches for missionaries, but we are mobile.
Well, that's good. So how big is your church? How many members do you have, would you say?
Just a few hundred at the most. And the other thing, too, though, is this brings up the question of how do you count your church membership? We don't count everyone who's ever been baptized until 120 years later, the way the mainstream church does. We really count our membership by those who actually show up to a solemn assembly, which you do need to recommend for, but it's sort of like our general conference. People who come to that, you know, then that's basically what we assume our membership actually is, because these are the active members. But, you know, you could come maybe to one and miss one, and we'd still count you, right? And, of course, you know, if we're not counting someone as a member, it doesn't mean we think that they've necessarily lost their blessings. We're not excommunicating them. We're not assuming that their ordinances aren't valid. That's all fine. So I suppose you could add a few hundred more if all those people counted who haven't been here in a few years. But we figure it's not exactly accurate to count them as full members if they're not going to show up. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, well, that's fine. So is your church relatively new then? Or how long has it been in existence?
Yeah, just over 40 years.
Oh, it's 40 years. Okay. So
that's relatively new.
You know, I know that a lot of times when people... Because would you guys... Oh, I should ask you this question. Are you guys Mormons?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have an I'm a Mormon bumper sticker.
Oh, you do?
A friend of mine who wasn't in our church. When Nelson gave the talk, she made up some I'm a Mormon bumper stickers. Just so that we could say, hey, you know, if the larger mainstream church doesn't want to claim it, we can be the real Mormons and they can be the ex-Mormons.
Very comfortable with being called a Mormon.
Okay.
Because I love the Book of Mormon. I mean, I just love it.
Yeah.
And it's a definite part of our canon of Scripture. So it's there.
So can you tell us a little bit more about your beliefs? What makes you distinctive from, say, and I'm going to call it the LDS Church. I'm not going to call it the Brighamites, whatever. We could, I guess. I usually prefer to call them
the Grantites. We're the real Brighamites. But,
oh, you're the Brighamites, and we're the Grantites?
Yeah. Grant, I think, innovated a lot more, as well as actually reestablishing the church legally on a different legal basis in the 1920s. Of course, that brings up the question of who's the breakoff. You were saying, when were we established? And we were saying, oh, about 40 years. But sometimes I do like to tease back instead that what you're really asking is, when did you break off us, right? Because we were established in 1830. By Joseph Smith, and you guys are the breakoff group. Well, because of course it's all just a matter of where you're coming from. So,
okay.
Well, some of the things that probably distinguish us is we actually have temples, and many of the fundamentalist Mormon faith movements have had temples, but in general, they have not. And right from the very beginning, we said we were inspired by Revelation to build a temple right from the get-go. And so that's been a main staple of our faith. And we do work for the living as well as for the dead.
Okay. Well, that's cool. And I think you guys have a temple here in Spanish Fork, is that correct?
No, but we do have meetings here, regular meetings here. But the temples, we only have two operatable temples right now. Okay. Though we did build an endowment house at one other point. But the temples are basically in southern Utah and in central Nevada.
Oh, for some reason I thought there was one in Spanish Fork, but okay, that's fine. Well, cool.
I do like going and visiting the Hare Krishna temple in Spanish Fork.
Oh.
I like to call that the Spanish Fork temple. That's not us.
That's not you. So, you know, I know, would you guys be comfortable with the term fundamentalists Mormons?
More or less.
Yeah.
And we consider ourselves Orthodox as well, because we're hearkening back to the same, you know, doctrine that Joseph and Brigham and John Taylor and I just keep going, mm-hmm. taught. But we know that things have changed in the LDS Church, and we're going back to the Orthodox faith and holding true to those doctrines.
So you'd prefer the term Orthodox Mormons?
We're comfortable with fundamental.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Fundamentalist has become basically shorthand, and it was really the mainstream church, I think, that coined the phrase, but we've more or less become comfortable with it as basically shorthand for any church that has plural marriage. We do have plural marriage in our church, and so, you know, that just makes it easy to break the ice and use the term. I think the main reason why you get pushback on that term, though, is that there are some real negative connotations if you think about it as equivalent to, say, Islamic fundamentalism, Al-Qaeda, or something like that. We're not necessarily more literalist. In fact, in some ways, I like to tease that in that sense, people who are overly legalistic, overly literalist, extremely strict, enforce a lot of rules, I say, well, it's the mainstream church that's the fundamentalist church, right? We're the ones I think are more open-minded, but...
Yeah. So, you know, as I look at you guys, I'm gonna pull out some of the stereotypes and say you guys aren't the stereotypical fundamentalists, we'll say, or polygamists, or whatever you want to say, but because you guys dress normal. Are you guys related to? Because I know Cody Brown's group is the Apostolic United Brethren. Are you guys associated with them at all, or are you former members of them? Or
not former members, no. But we do have. We have roots that are in common, but we are not associated with them.
Okay. So how did your church, because you said it officially organized 40 years ago, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 41 now, I guess.
Yeah, 41 now.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about how your church started?
Yeah, on April 6th, 1978, the church was organized. And at that time, most of the members were living in southern Utah, and not to be confused with places like Hilldale or Colorado City. We're not in that area at all, nor affiliated with the folks in that area.
Okay, so that would be FLDS church people,
right?
Search, right,
yeah. Right, and so we were over more west of Cedar City in that area. That's where they were. They started a united order there, and then established the church, and then our founder, Gerald Peterson Sr., was a doctor, and he had a practice here in Utah County. Yeah. And he was often up and down the road because, you know, it's hard to make a living west of Cedar City as a doctor. So he maintained a practice in Utah County.
So he was back and forth. That's a long commute.
That's only a few hours.
So like a couple days in Cedar City and a couple days up here, is that pretty much what he would do?
Yeah, and they'd hold meetings in the carriage house of the
Knight Mangum building.
Knight Mangum building where he had his practice in Provo on Center Street.
Okay. And so is he considered the prophet then?
Mm-hmm.
Gerald Peterson? Okay, is he still the prophet?
He passed away
in
the 80s.
Okay.
And then his son took over.
Okay.
As the prophecy and revelator.
And his name is?
And his name is also Gerald Peterson.
Okay.
But he's junior.
He's junior. Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess
we don't make it, because I talked to Jim Van Cannon. I know the Remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints believed that it needed to be a descendant of Joseph Smith. You guys don't believe that necessarily?
Well, we do have a lot of members who are descendants of Asel Smith, but no, we don't. And there is something to this doctrine of there being a patriarchal order or patriarchal son. And so there is some of that, that kind of went into that. But no, we're not all literal descendants of Joseph Smith himself either. And converts like me aren't related to Joseph Smith at all. So.
Right. And how about Gerald Peterson? Is he related to Joseph Smith as far as we know?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not. We wouldn't call it a requirement.
Okay. To be the prophet. So do you guys have a succession plan after Gerald dies? I assume he's serving for life. Or is it like the community of Christ? Yeah. You know, Wallace Smith stepped down, and they're not descendants of Joseph Smith anymore in the community of Christ.
Yeah, well, we do have a succession plan, and Gerald Peterson did pass away, junior.
The first one. Oh, the second one did.
He did pass away.
Oh, wow, okay.
And his son was able to be succeeded very simply, very smoothly, and everybody knew there wasn't any questions.
So is it always going to be a
Peterson?
And
he was also, it may or may not be.
Okay.
So that wasn't necessarily a requirement, but we knew that it was going to be another Peterson.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is that kind of what would you expect is another Peterson to just carry on? Is that the kind of the succession plan or?
Well, there's different ways that a succession can work, right? And we more or less understand and embrace all of those different theories that have existed in the Restoration, essentially. So, yes, you can be the patriarchal son, such as, you know, Joseph Smith III. Joseph Smith did expect and want Joseph Smith III to succeed him. And I think even Brigham Young said that he'd have to step aside if he felt that Joseph Smith III had ever stepped up to really embrace the fullness of the gospel as they understood it. But so there's a patriarchal son. There's also something called a second elder. Hiram Smith was second elder to Joseph Smith. I don't know how much the second elder theory has been used in any other LDS groups, but we've also done that as well. So, you know, the successor should be chosen ahead of time. That makes it easier for everybody to know who that second elder is so that there isn't any confusion or succession crisis.
Oh.
And, of course, you know, I think that would have been a lot smoother if Joseph had been martyred without Hiram being martyred also. That certainly would have prevented a lot of succession crisis problems in that first great crisis. And then, of course, you know, there's also the idea of president of the Quorum of the Twelve or seniority. And so far, at least we've avoided those crises by essentially following all three each time. So,
okay. Because I believe Oliver Cowdery was the first second elder, right?
That is correct, yeah. But he was
that communicated in 1930s.
18, of course.
I can't remember. In the 1830s, we'll just leave it there. But and then, yeah, Hiram certainly. I think they called him assistant president of the church.
Right. In fact, there's some talk about Joseph Smith trying to make him president so that the president of the priesthood and prophet, Joseph Smith, could be a different office held from the presidency of the church, which would have been held by Hiram Smith. But I think that there was some confusion, of course, in the early church about conflating the two roles. And so it was never official that Hiram was president of the church, just co-president of the church, instead of fully separating those two offices.
Yeah. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with David Patrick and Benjamin Schaefer from Christ Church. In our next conversation, we're going to talk more about the scriptures they use. They have quite an expanded canon.
We generally, of course, use the ones printed by the LDS Church, but then on top of that, we use a lot of other materials. We've used the Book of Jasher, for example, or the other Midrash. I've put together a little booklet for people to insert in their scriptures called the Addendum to the Doctrine and Covenants, which has 8 of the uncanonized revelations, or that weren't canonized, I guess, in the mainstream LDS church, but that we also accept and use. And then there's a whole other body.
John Taylor's Revelation, is that one of them?
That's one of them. John Taylor's 1886 Revelation is, of course, one of the ones that I guess was controversial for the mainstreamers, but we accept that as a revelation. It's well established historically, at the very least.
Yeah.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please support Gospel Tangents and become a subscriber. For just $5 a month, go to patreon.com/gospeltangents and you can hear the entire interview. And you can also get transcripts available in either our Amazon website, or if you want to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website at gospeltangents.com and you can click the yellow subscribe button. Of course, we're also on Facebook, Twitter, and all the other places. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. And don't forget to click here to subscribe on YouTube, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again for listening.